Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So, Robert.
Yes.
A horse, a rat, a dragon, and a metal pig walk into a bar.
Okay.
The dragon says, I'm a dragon, everybody else leave, and they do, because he's a dragon.
Well, that would make sense. We're, of course, talking about the Chinese zodiac here, and you basically just described my family to a certain extent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I am my zodiac sign in the Chinese zodiac is horse. My son's is dragon. My wife's is actually pig, but for the longest, she thought she was a rat.
Wait, how can you be confused? I thought it was just the year you were born.
It's easy to make that mistake, especially if, you know, you're just sort of going on a surface level understanding of it, particularly if the surface in question is a placemat at a Chinese restaurant.
That's
from
exactly,
the 1980s.
That is exactly where I learned about the Chinese zodiac first. When I was a child in probably the early 1990s, I remember my family was one time eating at a Chinese restaurant, and the placemat at my seat had all the drawings of the animals and years listed under them. And that's where I got to find out that I am a tiger, which sounded really cool at the time. But now I find out that that's not such a cool thing.
Yeah, it gets a little more complicated than that. And in terms of just being able to easily mistake what your animal might be, it's because the Chinese zodiac is an astrological birth chart based upon the lunisolar calendar year.
So it doesn't just match the solar calendar that we use.
Right. The months are lunar, but the years are solar. So that means it's a little off from the Gregorian calendar.
Uh-huh.
And there's a little bit of a drift on the relative start and stop points. So if you just look at the animal name and a year, you could get it wrong if you have a birthday in January or February,
mm-hmm.
Where we see this overlap.
And your wife does have a birthday in January or February?
Yeah, she has a February birthday. So for the longest, she thought that she was a rat, but in actuality, she was pig.
Now, there are also elements associated with certain years, right? So she's not just a pig. She's what? A wooden pig? An earth pig?
Oh, she's a metal pig, which I think is the probably... It sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, Metal Gear Solid, Metal Pig.
Yeah, there are different astrological versions of each one. So, you know, Metal Pig, Water Pig, Wood Pig, Fire Pig, and Earth Pig.
Nice.
Would be the complete pig collection. And just to give everyone an idea of where we are right now, as we're recording this in late January 2016, we are about to enter into the year of the fire monkey.
What was this previous year here?
We are exiting the year of the goat.
Okay, so bye-bye goat. All babies born today still goats, but pretty soon they will be fire monkeys instead.
That's right. Yeah, there are 12 different animals involved here in the zodiac. And they go in a particular order. You have rat, ox, tiger, rabbit, dragon, snake, horse, goat, monkey, rooster, dog, and then pig. And then it goes back around.
Okay, so we'll get to know those animals a little bit more as the episode goes on. But we should have a little disclaimer here at the beginning if you're like, wait a minute, I thought we were going to be talking about science in the science podcast. So we are going to be talking about Chinese astrology in this episode, but it's worth noting that we're not necessarily endorsing Chinese astrology or any form of astrology or divination as an accurate tool for learning about reality. But instead, examining it as a thing that exerts a powerful influence over human culture and behavior.
Yeah, the mythology and the symbolism is fascinating, and it's also potent in Eastern culture. And we can actually study the ramifications of it from an economic standpoint, from birth rate standpoint. It's all really interesting stuff. So yeah, if you're rolling your eyes at the astrology, bear with us. Because we're going to get to numbers. We're going to get to the science.
Okay, we should check in real quick with what the Stuff to Blow Your Minds animal signs are before we move on. So as we said, I'm a tiger, but it turns out I'm married to a rat. Okay. Rats run strong in this world, and I appreciate their power and craftiness. Our other host on this podcast, Christian Sager, is a snake married to a rabbit, which sounds like a very fortuitous union.
Yeah, and
Noel, what are you again? Is he a fire pig?
I don't think we know. We know he's not a metal pig, but I'm not sure where he falls in line with the other descriptors here.
He's a magic pig.
Maybe.
Okay, so as we said, there are 12 signs in the Chinese zodiac, and if you're familiar primarily with the Western zodiac, there will be some similarities and some differences. Now, in the Western Zodiac, we primarily judge things by the time of the year that you were born.
Yeah, it's seasonal in nature. Yeah.
And I think there are some other elements to the traditional Chinese astrology, right? There are things about the time of the day you were born or the time of year. But this one thing that makes it onto the Chinese placemat, sort of the easily recognizable large-scale view of Chinese birth characteristics in this cultural form of astrology, is based on the year you were born.
Right.
And there are 12 years in this cycle. They are those 12 animals. And what's the story? Where do these animals come from? And where do we get these ideas about what their personality characteristics are?
Well, this is the way the story goes. And this is just one version of the story. So if you grew up with this or have encountered it in a book somewhere, you may have a slightly different version in your head. But it rolls out like this. According to legend, the Jade Emperor.
So who's the Jade Emperor?
Oh, he's the heavenly grandfather. He's a mythological ruler, very important in Taoism. He's an emperor in a myth-rich ancient time. Okay. And he wants to create a method of recording the passage of time.
Okay.
So he does the logical thing. He organizes a swim race on his birthday and invites a bunch of animals. Okay. And
now, are these all water animals? Are they fish?
No, none of them are water animals.
They're the ones we've been talking about before.
Yes, yes.
Pigs and goats and stuff.
And plus cat was also invited, according to the version I read. So
that would make it 13 animals, right?
Yes, but as we're going to see, things aren't going to really work out for the cat all that well. And then this is fun story, by the way. I actually acted this out with my son yesterday using toy animals. So if you need a rainy day activity for your child, I recommend this.
That's so beautiful.
Okay, so let's roll with it. Jade Emperor says go. You know, the starter pistol goes off. Cat and rat are standing there. They're the slowest swimmers. So what they do is they ask to ride on the ox. But then once they're out in the water, the rat pushes the cat off into the water, and the cat is, I guess, washed away by the current. And then the ox moves in and the rat jumps off of the ox's back and gets there first. So first place goes to rat.
Okay, so the ox is fording the river like an Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
And the rat rides on his back, jumps ahead, sort of cheats. Is this maybe sort of cheating?
Well, yeah, it's cheating, but he's also using his intellect, and he comes up with a creative way. He knows he's not a great swimmer. Mm-hmm. He knows the ox is pretty good. This seems like a logical plan.
Yeah, yeah, rats are crafty. They're like Templeton in Charlotte's Web.
Exactly. So next comes the tiger, just, you know, plunges headfirst across.
No, wait a minute. Can tigers swim? The cat can't swim. Why can the tiger swim?
Oh, well, the cat can swim. The cat was just pushed off.
Not a good swimmer.
Not a good swimmer. The tiger can swim, makes it across. Next comes the rabbit. Rabbit's not a good swimmer, but the rabbit crosses the river by hopping on the stones.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes dragon. And dragon's, of course, going to be very important. We're going to discuss dragon in more depth here in a bit. But being a flying cosmic creature, he could have easily come in first. But along the way, he realized he needed to stop and generate some rain to control the weather and then continue on his way. So he wasn't even really that concerned with winning this thing.
Uh-huh.
He had more important duties to attend to.
Right. So he's a magnanimous runner up. He could have easily won by flying, but he had other things on his agenda.
Exactly. Now next comes, my sign and Christian's sign. So here comes snake and horse.
All right.
Now horse, pretty good swimmer. So horse is gonna just swim across the river. Snake sneaks aboard, wraps around the horse's leg, and then when the horse is about to climb out of the river and earn its place, horse sees the snake, freaks out, because horses are afraid of snakes, and the snake jumps off and secures the next place in line, followed by the horse. So a little trickery on the snake's part.
Okay. I like these trickster animals.
Yeah. Now, next comes, in this order, goat, monkey, and rooster, but the interesting thing here is that they all apparently work rather well together. And the Jade Emperor is very appreciative of this. It's a good teamwork, guys.
These three, did they build a raft? Did I read that?
I believe so. I think that's in some of the versions that's their method of teamwork.
Nice.
Yeah, otherwise, I guess, you know, they could pile on each other's heads or something and walk across.
Yeah, that's smart. Okay, who's next?
Well, next comes Dog. And Dog is the strongest swimmer of the bunch, but he's also easily distracted. So basically, he just played and splashed in the water for most of the race and then realized, oh, I need to actually get across.
Man, our dog's great.
And then comes Pig, who, rather stereotypically here, falls asleep after eating during the journey. So he's a very late arriver to the other side.
So this is in the classic tortoise and the hare story. The pig is the hare in this version. He just decides to take a nap.
Yeah, yeah. And then finally, the cat makes its way across the river after being betrayed by the rat earlier. But the cat is too late to qualify, so the cat does not make it into the official Chinese zodiac and is instead just left on the outside hating the rat for all eternity.
Man. That's harsh.
Yeah. So it's a fun little story. It doesn't give a perfect description of all the astrological significance of each animal, but it gives you kind of a base understanding. And it's far better than some of the other. There's actually one version where apparently the Buddha simply calls all the animals together and names years after them, which sounds like a pretty boring party.
Yeah. Why not have a river race? I mean, you can't make a reality show out of Buddha naming people.
Yeah. So Joe, let's just roll through these various animals just one final time here to just lay out their positive and negative attributes.
Yeah, because we will be talking about in this episode the personality characteristics that are typically attributed to each of these animals in the 12-year cycle. If you're born under the year, these are the attributes that are supposed to belong to you. So the first one we've got is the rat. Now, what do they say about the rat?
Well, the rat is innovative, opportunistic, very organized, but prone to letting his temper get out of control and possibly his or her greed.
Now, I've got to give credit where credit is due. I was reading this out loud to my wife, Rachel, last night, and mm-hmm. She was like, sounds like Walter White from Breaking Bad.
All right,
I was like, Walter White, that's exactly right. That is the perfect rat.
Okay, so that's a good sort of modern fictional embodiment.
Uh-huh.
Next up, the ox, of course. The ox is honest, conservative, patient, but the ox can be stubborn when pushed and can be slow to start things.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple fictional versions we came up with to match this sounds kind of like Ned Stark from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Kind of an honest, respectable, but conservative person. Another option I came up with is Ellen Ripley from the Alien series.
Ooh, that's a good one.
You know, because she is essentially she's one of the few heroes who's really a rule follower. She's all about obeying protocol. We need to do the right thing here and not break quarantine. You know, she's conservative, but she's patient. She's on top of things and she doesn't want to budge from her position.
And unlike the astrological ox, she actually gets the cat across the river. You know, so to
say. Oh, Jonesy. Okay. Next we have the tiger, right? This is mine.
Yeah.
So they say about the tiger that the tiger is powerful, brave, and a risk taker, but can also be very brash and offensive. Ruffle feathers cause trouble. So what came to my mind is Fox Mulder from the X-Files.
Ah, yeah.
You know, he's a risk taker. He's courageous. He stands up for what he believes in, but he really just makes people mad. He says the wrong thing and he makes offensive comments all the time.
Ah, okay. I feel like, you know, the tiger character is one we probably see a lot in fiction. Cause we like characters like that. We like our characters to be strong and confident, but also have certain pitfalls. The one that comes to my mind, and this is because I'm currently watching AMC's Halt and Catch Fire, Lee Pace's character, Joe McMillan. Brilliant risk taker, but also just a life-wrecking idiot at times.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right, next up we have the rabbit. Gentle, talented, diplomatic, but maybe a little bit shy and sentimental.
Okay, what have you got for the rabbit?
The only one that came to mind instantly here is Luna Lovegood in Harry Potter.
Oh, you know? That's a pretty good one. Yeah.
All right, next is a very important one, dragon. Imagination, energetic, dramatic, but can be moody, can be a perfectionist, and of course, as we'll discuss, there are destructive elements to the dragon as well.
Huh. You know, I had a hard time thinking of a good example of a dragon in fiction.
Yeah.
One that obviously came to mind is another one from Game of Thrones, Daenerys Targaryen.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't know how well she fits that because I don't really think of her as dramatic or even necessarily moody. But well, certainly that imagination and energy and she's very determined.
Yeah. I think she is prone to being a little moody, especially later in the series.
Yeah, I guess so.
But yeah, it's not a perfect fit. Though of course she is the mother of dragons, so it seems like it should fit.
Yeah. Are we going to have too many Game of Thrones characters in this? It's just such a rich world to draw various character personalities from, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the next one's Snake. The snake is graceful, intuitive, and wise, but prone to stinginess and unscrupulous behavior.
I guess this is what I was referring to here, because it sounds like the spider, Lord Varys from Game of Thrones.
There you go.
Old Baldy. He is graceful, he is intuitive, and he is wise, but he's not necessarily so full of scruples.
Well, the next one is horse, my sign, and this one's characterized by being energetic, spirited, optimistic, independent, but prone to impatience and unfinished tasks.
Does that sound like you to you?
Well, as we'll get into later, just about any of these, you can see yourself in them if you want to.
That's a good point. Yeah, we'll get into that.
Yeah. So I do see a bit of myself in that. And in terms of fictional characters, it makes me think of Clive Owen's Dr. John Thackeray on The Nick, who is, very energetic and spirited, but does not have the patience for rigorous scientific investigation.
Yeah.
And will also just completely abandon a task if it's not really working out.
You gotta be cautious about those people who have an emphasis on getting things done. You know, I haven't seen The Nick, but I've heard it's very good.
Oh, I love it. I highly recommend it. For individuals who aren't too squeamish about a turn of the century surgery scene.
Okay. How about the next one? Goat. They say the goat is loving, gentle, and creative, but maybe shy and reluctant to directness and set in their ways.
Well, this one I thought was kind of difficult because that's not really the type of central character you tend to encounter in a story.
Yeah.
But it did make me think of Donnie from The Big Lebowski.
Aw. You know? Yeah. Donnie who loves surfing. He was sweet. Yeah. Loving and creative.
All right. Next, we have the monkey. And again, we're about to enter into monkey. Smart, happy, curious, energetic, but prone to overconfidence and all the pitfalls that come with overconfidence.
So the one that came to my mind based on this is Tony Stark from Iron Man. So this is a guy who likes to have a good time. He's curious. He's full of energy. He's very smart, but he's kind of full of himself.
Yeah, I think that's a good fit. All right, next up we have Rooster. Rooster is punctual, reliable, independent, but maybe a bit conceited. This one was a hard one for me to really think about in terms of modern fiction, but...
Yeah, again, how many characters can you think of that are known for punctuality?
Yeah, and being vain without being just like movie vain or Dorian Gray vain. The one that came to mind, though, is Christoph Waltz's character, Dr. King Schultz in Django Unchained.
Oh, okay.
Because he's a great planner, he's loyal, but he's ultimately brought down by his own form of vanity, more of a cultural, intellectual vanity, a physical vanity.
He can't walk away. He's got to make his point.
Yeah, he's got to make his point, even if it's the most disastrous choice in the movie. Yeah.
Okay, so we got two left. One of them is the dog. And what do they say about the dog?
So the dog is gregarious, honest, fun, loyal, prone to worrying, whimpering in the corner.
That's an interesting combination of things. Two people came to mind for me. One of them is another Big Lebowski character. It'd be the dude from the Big Lebowski. So he's gregarious, honest, fun, loyal. He's all those things, but he also worries a lot. He's worried that they're going to cut off various parts of his body. Another one that came to my mind is, have you seen Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt?
Oh, yes.
Netflix
yeah,
series.
It.
Kimmy Schmidt, she's a dog here.
I think so.
I mean, she's in the Chinese zodiac sense, very much gregarious, honest, loyal, fun, and prone to worrying. Another one that maybe came to my mind is Gromit from Wallace and Gromit, but that he's kind of disqualified because he's actually a dog.
All right. And then finally, last place, Pig. Pig is noble, strong, fiercely loyal to family and friends, though they can be difficult at times and can be a bit reckless.
This is another one I got to credit to my wife, Rachel. I was talking to her about this last night, and she was like, Mrs. Voorhees from Friday the 13th.
But a strong mother, right?
Yeah.
Well, another mother that comes to mind from Game of Thrones, Cersei Lannister, who, for all her faults, and she has many, she's very loyal to her children, specifically, and pretty much only to her children. You know, it's all about protecting her children, and she can be a bit reckless outside of that.
Robert, you've designed websites before, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I mean, I love a good website, but it can be so tedious to try and manage to build one out of the tools at hand.
Yeah, without a really good suite of tools, it can just be such a pain getting the site to look the way you want, to be easy and intuitive and work well for the audience you're trying to reach with the website. But fortunately, it doesn't always have to be such a pain.
That's right, because now we have a new set of tools at our disposal thanks to Squarespace.
Right, Squarespace is there to make it easy, simple, intuitive, and very professional. So it gets you a site that looks professionally designed, even if you don't really have any skills with web design, or if you do, regardless of skill level, you don't need to know how to code a web page.
And that's crucial, because I feel like anytime I build or augment a website myself, I have to relearn very primitive codings.
And you can get a free domain if you sign up for a year.
Yeah, and we want everyone listening here to have the same opportunity. So why don't you start your free trial today at Squarespace.com, and when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code MINDBLOWN to get 10% off your first purchase. Again, the promo code is MINDBLOWN. The product is Squarespace. Go try it out and build that website you've been dreaming of.
Okay, so that has been the basic crash course on the very popularly, broadly accessible version of the Chinese Zodiac. But now we want to get more into the specifics about the scientifically measurable effects of belief in the Chinese zodiac, what people think about it, how it influences culture, and what economic and sociological influences it might have.
And I know what a lot of you are thinking, too, at this point, that it's one thing to think about a seasonal zodiac having its effect, right? You know, this individual was born in winter, this one in summer, etc. But, how could everybody in a single year have the same basic personality type? It's unbelievable. It's just ridiculous, really. Like, everybody born in the year of the dragon is not going to be this massive go-getter leader person. Everybody born in the year of the rat is not going to be this unscrupulous individual. So how does it work? How does it end up, playing into our perceptions of self, our perceptions of what our offspring should be, and even how we should hire people?
Yes. And now we're going to turn our attention to the dragon child, the children born in the year of the dragon. Why is the year of the dragon considered special in the Chinese zodiac?
Ah, well, this is a great question. And I promise I'm not going to spend an excessive amount of time here. We're going to maybe do an episode on dragons later on. Yeah. But just to be brief about it, you know, the Western dragon is this earthy, wormy, often downright infernal creature. The yeah. Eastern dragon is a celestial creature.
So there's a big difference here because in Western mythology, the dragon is very often a monster.
Right.
It's a thing that must be fought or defeated. It's a thing that causes havoc. It's a threat. And it often is not very, sometimes even not very sentient. I mean, it depends on which mythology you're going with.
Right.
But yeah, it's a big monstrous thing that's gross and you don't want it around.
Right. Yeah. It's coiling up out of the ground. Whereas the celestial dragon of the East, the Chinese dragon, is coming out of the sky. It's controlling the weather. It's controlling the flow of the rivers. It's controlling the ocean. It's all about potency and strength. It's a divine creature. It's sometimes a bearer of gods and demigods, but often the dragon itself is viewed as a god or demigod in terms of its power. It's not only an important creature among the Han people, the primary ethnic group in China, but also for the other 56 ethnic groups. The dragon is old and just and predates the other religions and philosophies that flowed into China, such as Taoism, Buddhism, Islam, etc.
So it sounds like the listeners who are familiar with the Western dragon, just we're all going to have this stumbling block in our understanding of the significance of the dragon in Chinese culture.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, so often the dragon plays into creation myths. One in particular that I like, the Miao people of southwest China believe that the divine dragon lived in a cave and a bunch of monkeys came to the cave and the dragon breathed on the monkeys and turned them into humans.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That also sounds like a perfectly adaptable creation myth of humanity if you're a person who wants to fuse a traditional creation myth with modern evolutionary theory.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it sounds like, I'm instantly imagining a dragon showing up in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
yeah.
And I should also point out that occasionally you do have an evil dragon or a very destructive dragon, but for the most part, even if they're destructive, it has more to do with their tie to like primal forces of nature than anything. Another thing to keep in mind about the dragon is that there are basically two different ways to look at what their composition is.
Uh-huh.
Like you have to think, we have such a clear idea in our mind of what a dragon is, even an Eastern dragon.
It's a huge lizard with wings that breathes fire.
Yeah, and it's very ornate, and we tend not to think about, you know, what is this composed of. But according to an excellent book, Handbook of Chinese Mythology by Liu Yang, Deming An, and Jessica Anderson Turner, there are two ways to look at it. One is that a dragon is basically crocodile, tornado, lightning, river, all sort of put together.
Huh.
But you can also see the dragon as a composite of various fanciful images of other important creatures, creatures that were important to various tribes in ancient China that were then integrated. So that, you know, there's several different types of Chinese dragon as the myths roll out over the centuries, but you'll see interesting descriptions of their composite parts. Head of a horse, tail of a snake, ears of a deer, horns of an ox, rabbit's eyes, clam's abdomen.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
Clam's abdomen?
Yeah.
I mean the abdomen of a clam or an abdomen just covered in clam shells?
I don't know. I like both interpretations. fish scales, tiger paws, eagle talons. So it's interesting to think, to me, I can't help but think, well, to what extent is not only the dragon the only mythological creature on the zodiac, he is also composed of elements from various other animals.
It's the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, it's like an animal Voltron. So yeah, the dragon is big business. People of China often think of themselves as the children of the dragon. The five-clawed dragon was an exclusive symbol of later dynasties. The Chang dynasty from 1644 to 1911, the flag featured a coiled dragon against a yellow background. So the dragon is just inherently tied with Chinese culture.
Okay, so you can definitely see why the dragon carries a lot of mythological and cultural significance, but what is it specifically supposed to mean for a child born in the year of a dragon? Because all of the animals we described in that long list of the zodiac, they all had admirable characteristics, and the dragon just seemed like another one of them with some kind of general, vague, admirable characteristics listed. So what makes a dragon special?
I mean, basically, I mean, you can list off a bunch of adjectives like honest, courageous, powerful, sensitive, but basically they're a go-getter. Like they're the kid that you want. You want your child to be this dragon that is fierce enough to win at life, but also, you know, humble and important enough to not get, you know, and to not fall into the rat's situation of sort of cheating to get to the head of the line.
Yeah. So it is primarily, it is an animal that is powerful and can get things done and will move to the head of the pack, but is also concerned with duty, right? With helping others and with doing what it needs to do. You said it stopped to make the rain and that's why it didn't win. It just wasn't all that bothered about winning.
Yeah. According to Chinese astrology, the dragon, that's who you want leading your company, right? Leading your nation, not one of those tigers.
Yeah, because the tiger is another one that you could maybe think of as a go-getter. Remember that they're courageous, they're powerful, they can get things done. But there are negative characteristics associated with the tiger. And in some Chinese cultures, it seems like especially in like Singapore and Taiwan or maybe Hong Kong, the tiger is considered an undesirable birth sign, or at least it has been in the past. There was a 2011 article by Jens Kastner in the Asia Times called "Tiger Throttling Taiwan's Birth Rate." And it says that it lists some years of the tiger. It says whoever was born in 1950, 1962, 1974, 1986, my birth year, or 1998, tends to question authority and is therefore likely to cause trouble for himself, his family, or his employers at some stage in life.
Yeah, I think this was also the article that pointed out that some firms would actually hire a fortune teller to go through the applications that were coming in, to go through the resumes and look at the birth years.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, because in order to prevent tigers from coming in and wrecking your office place.
You know, another thing that's interesting is that the tiger is different than all of the other animals in the zodiac in one important respect, right?
Oh, yeah. It's the only real meat eater. The only real man eater, rather, on the list.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you could, in some wild circumstances, maybe a pig or a dog or something could attack a person. But the tiger is the only one that's a definite human predator.
Yeah, it's a definite real world threat.
Don't get carried away, by the way. Don't think that means you should go hunt tigers. Most of the time they don't attack people, but we're saying potentially could.
Yeah. And again, back to your point, it's not something you see just across the board, but certain areas are going to have more of the stigma about the tiger than others, in the same way that you'll go to other nations, other nationalities, and find the tiger as more of a noble creature. So it just varies depending on where you are.
Okay, so but back to dragons. There's a general idea that dragons are successful and have good lives. There's good fate for a dragon. They're going to get good grades. They're going to find success in life. They're going to bring honor to the family. They're just going to be good ones to have in your family. Are there any famous dragons you can list, born in the year of the dragon so we can see what a dragon looks like?
Oh, yeah. And again, it's easy to put together a list like this, right?
Uh-huh.
Because out of any given year, there are going to be some exemplary examples of accomplishment and fame. So you got Bruce Lee, you got actress Maggie Cheung, you got former Chinese Paramount leader Deng Xiaoping. You got Liam Neeson, John Lennon, Salvador Dali, Sigmund Freud, Pele, Guillermo del Toro, Stephen Colbert, Sarah Palin, Benedict Cumberbatch, Sasha Gray, Conor McGregor, Vladimir Putin, the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Oh, okay, I'm sold. Randy Savage.
Mr. T, Paul Rubens, Chuck Norris, Frank Zappa, Wayne Dyer, John Gotti, Fred Savage, Che Guevara, Stanley Kubrick, and Philip K. Dick. Richard Pryor and Rashida Jones, just to name a few.
The only one I needed to hear was Macho Man Randy Savage. Now I understand. The dragon fate leads to a Slim Jim ad deal.
Now, you probably noticed we did have some Chinese names on there, but most of those were Western examples. And part of that is that we're more versed in Western pop culture here than we are in Chinese culture. But the other thing is when you start trying to pick out examples of Chinese dragons, yes, you'll find some good examples. But I actually was looking around, I'm poking around on the top 10 entries on the Forbes China Celebrity 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at everything between 2004 and 2015. Again, the top 10, the famous, important people, a lot of them in entertainment, but some in business. And the only top tenor that I found between 2004 and 2015 that was a dragon was Chinese director Chen Kagi, who directed the acclaimed 1993 film Farewell, My Concubine.
Huh.
Now, this basically all means nothing, but I think it is important to look at, you know, as we try to figure out, does being born in the dragon, does being a dragon actually have any tangible benefit on your life? You know, certainly not due to any kind of magical astrological reason, but due to just the importance that is projected on you.
Well, obviously, some parents seem to think so, because it turns out to be a fact that the dragon year has been a boom year for baby births in many Chinese cultures, right?
Yeah, and this is where we really get into analyzing the tangible power of the thing.
Uh-huh.
To what extent does the desire to have a dragon as your offspring, to birth a dragon, to what extent does that actually influence the birth rate of a given population that is, you know, under the power of this superstitious thinking?
Now, you linked me to a really interesting piece on this by a writer named Rosie Sema, right?
Yeah, this is a Priceonomics piece, and 2015 piece, and she does a really good job just rolling through some of the statistics here.
It was called How the Chinese Zodiac Affects National Birth Rates.
Yes. And another paper that found particularly helpful was a 1991 paper called Creating New Traditions in Modern Chinese Populations, Aiming for Birth in the Year of the Dragon by Daniel M. Goodkind. Mm-hmm. That was published in Population and Developmental Review.
Okay, so what's the deal? What are the stats on birth rates in dragon years tell us?
Basically, and we're gonna break this down a bit, but basically you do see spikes in particular areas that line up with the year of the dragon.
Right. So this is supposed to, I think what we were mainly looking at was measuring fertility rates among ethnic Chinese in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and other places, right?
Yeah. Peninsular Malaysia,
yeah.
And other parts of Asia. And that we also looked at data for mainland China, for the People's Republic of China as
yeah.
well.
Okay, so let's look at one non-dragon year to dragon year transition, and what does it look like?
Okay, well, one of the big ones here, one of the most impressive areas in the stats, in 76 and 88, fertility rates among Chinese in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Peninsular Malaysia, and other parts of Asia surged, and in 88, particularly, the rabbit to dragon increase in Singapore and Peninsular Malaysia was a whopping 24% to 26%.
Wait, so it went up by 24% or 26%.
Correct.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, to put this in perspective, the only other times we see surges of this magnitude in the birth rate, it involves something really major happening. For instance, 1966, the prohibition of abortion in Romania
right.
caused a substantial spike like this.
I guess I could imagine maybe at the conclusion of a civil war or some other huge human disaster that was preventing births.
Yes, I mean, a particular example of that also comes from China in 1962. Everybody's recovering from the famine of the Great Leap Forward.
Huh.
So some other examples, in 2000, Hong Kong saw more than a 5% rise in the number of births, according to official data.
Just to be clear, that's another dragon year.
And when questioned about this in various polls, there are parents who are saying, yes, we were trying to aim for that dragon year. In 2011, 2012, during a BBC poll, prospective parents in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Singapore all admitted to consciously timing their pregnancy for a dragon year. In that same year, by the way, China was anticipating a 5% birth rate increase.
Huh.
That's mainland China itself. They didn't quite hit that, as we'll discuss in a bit, but there was a boost.
Now, I expect this would be interesting to see in contrast to what I bet you'd find in especially some of these areas, which would be a generally downward trending birth rate, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly matching up with some of these signs that are viewed as less desirable, such as the tiger, as we've already mentioned. In 2010, Taiwan's fertility rate was already trending downward. But then year of the tiger hits, and the drop made it plummet to 0.895, one of the lowest in the world.
Huh.
Yeah, and then 2012, dragon year, 2 years later, it brought the fertility rate back up to 1.27, higher than it had been in almost a decade.
That's interesting, because the tiger and dragon years come pretty close together, right?
Yeah, it's tiger, rabbit, and then dragon. So, you know, if you're if you're skipping tiger year, you could aim for rabbit, or I guess you can just hold on and then try and calibrate your reproductive schedule so that you hit dragon instead of rabbit.
Man, to be that rabbit caught between the tiger and the dragon.
It's worth noting that these population trends have an impact on a number of factors, from just an individual dragon's school experience and college aspirations to the effects on institutions and services. I mean, imagine a hospital or school rolling with the lull and boom of tiger and dragon years.
Oh, yeah. Or imagine if there's a huge surge in the number of children during a dragon year. Imagine the year all of those children start leaving school and entering the workforce.
Right.
I mean, there's going to be a suddenly way more supply of adult workers than the market was prepared to absorb.
Right. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking to yourself, well, hey, Robert and Joe, Chinese Zodiac's been around for thousands and thousands of years. So surely the dragon surge has been in effect for thousands and thousands of years.
I don't think there's any evidence of that, is there?
No. The evidence seems to suggest the opposite, that the dragon effect on birth rates has only been in effect since the 1970s.
Huh. Now, why would that be? Surely, now, what I would not suspect is that more people started believing in astrology in the 1970s.
Right. And certainly it seems like it's the opposite. I mean, there are certainly still going to be individuals who heavily believe in it, and it still has just a lot of cultural power over mm-hmm. people and just symbolic power. But, you know, as modernization takes hold, and especially, in communist China, there is, for a while, a tendency to move away from old beliefs and certainly superstition.
Uh-huh. Though we will definitely talk in a little bit about exactly to what extent true belief in the power of the zodiac really figures into this. Like, how deeply do you have to believe in it to time for a dragon birth?
Right.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gaginianaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Now, you know, one of the big factors, obviously, is that you see birth control becoming more of an option, right?
In the 1970s,
yeah, it becomes widely available in the affected areas. So family planning becomes more of a reality, planning around finances and ambitions, but also the ability to plan around the astrological calendar.
Oh, that makes sense.
So that is an argument that is generally made for why we see this modern boom.
Yeah, and there's a parallel that goes along with this in this often cited paper on this subject called The Influence of the Chinese Zodiac on Fertility in Hong Kong SAR by Paul S.F. Yip, Joseph Lee, and Y.B. Chung, right?
Yeah, they point out that prior to the 1970s, yeah, there was no family planning at all, really. You just had kids for as long as you could. You just grew the family as large as you could, and that was life. You'll have a dragon in the family, maybe. You'll have a tiger, you'll have a horse, but that's just how things rolled out. But then, of course, the age of contraception begins to change that. Certainly, you reach the point in the late 1970s where the People's Republic of China rolls out the one-child policy, and this, it's believed, might have had an effect on zodiological birth timing as well.
Now that brings us to another interesting question, which is the mainland China itself, the People's Republic of China. We've been talking about places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, but there seems to be some disagreement or at least some ambiguity in the numbers about to what extent this phenomenon has presented itself in China, right?
Yeah, because you just don't see those same spikes in the data for mainland China at least until 2000, if not 2012.
Now, I have to admit that I was a little confused by the numbers here because I was seeing some conflicting reports about whether this dragon birth surge does show up in China or not for the past couple of cycles.
Yeah, because on one hand, I saw a stat that said China's crude birth rate was 6.8% higher in 2000. But then some other data, particularly some data in that Priceonomics paper, seemed to show it as being rather flat for 2000.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do look at the statistics from 2011, 2012, 2013, according to the website Statista, the number of Chinese births went from 16.04 million in 2011 to 16.35 million in 2012. So there was a 1.9% bump in the birth rate then. But then in the years to follow, you see 16.4 million births in 2013, 16.87 million in 2014. So the growth continues regardless of the sign.
Huh. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Now, there are different ways to look at that. I've seen it argued that essentially the population is just so vast in mainland China that any boost that's taking place in various regions is just going to be lost in the weight of the population data.
Right. So there might be some parts of the culture where the dragon births do prevail, but it's just become such a small blip on the radar of Chinese population dynamics that it doesn't really show up as a very strong trend.
Yes. To see the strong trend, you have to look to Taiwan, Singapore, those other examples.
Okay.
Now this brings us back to the question of why, right?
Yeah.
Why is in a modern setting, why is this ancient, superstitious manner of thinking, why is this suddenly exerting more control in some areas of Chinese culture? Well, a few things to keep in mind here. First of all, this first point comes to us from a paper, Creating New Traditions in Modern Chinese Populations Aiming for Birth in the Year of the Dragon. This is that Goodkind article.
Mm-hmm.
It points out that Chinese astrology traditionally places more emphasis on the day and hour of the birth rather than the year.
Huh.
So, because if you break down the traditional Chinese day, it's composed of 12 hours, one for each animal that we've already mentioned. So therefore, the roots here seem to be perhaps less the 2,000 plus year tradition of Chinese astrology, and rather it's more a matter of a cloud of loose modern folk beliefs.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So it's not so much that people are deeply superstitious or deeply involved in, you know, ancient Chinese magical beliefs, but there's more just kind of like, it's the placemat zodiac.
Yeah.
It's the most easily accessible and broadly available impressions of the Chinese zodiac that filter through into having large effects on culture.
Yeah, yeah. It's, except it's not only on your menu, it's in your house, it's in the park, it's part of, it's just the shadow of it is just unavoidable. So as you find yourself in a modern setting where you get to be choosier about everything regarding your family, you get to be choosier about how many children you have, regardless if you live under the one child policy or not. You have all these choices you can make, choices based on, you know, what the kid's going to wear, when the kid's going to be born, what kind of schooling is going to be involved there. And so the superstition ends up weighing into that choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another factor to keep in mind here, and this is brought up by Goodkind in his article, is that, you know, we make arguments about modern contraception and their role.
Right. That was one explanation offered
right.
for why this didn't show up until the 70s.
Yeah, because suddenly people can choose when they're going to have kids. But as he argues, ancient texts indicate that there were various methods on the table to adjust sexual behavior and aim for the dragon birth if that's what a couple wanted.
Huh.
You mean you had infanticide, you had, you know, abortive agents you could get from a Chinese apothecary, but of particular note for Goodkind was Taoist practices of semen retention.
Huh.
And this, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here too much, but basically this gets into yin and yang and male and feminine energy and this Taoist idea that if you could control your ejaculation and ejaculate less semen during intercourse, then you could better retain your yang energy and possibly even absorb a little bit of your partner's yin energy.
You wrote about this in, you had a post about the fox spirit, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, it plays into that a little bit because the fox spirit is a feminine creature that can drain you of your vital yang essence. Basically, the main idea here is that there were various alchemical sexual practices to control ejaculation. And granted, the emphasis here wasn't on contraception. It was more on, you know, this magical belief system of yin and yang. But the ancient Chinese knew how reproduction worked. They knew where babies came from.
So you're saying, like, even a long time ago, before modern birth control, if they were really concerned about timing for dragon births, they could have done it.
Yeah, if there was a real, tangible, cultural emphasis put on aiming for that dragon birth, they could have done it if they wanted to. Now, Goodkind also argues that the snake year, which comes immediately after the dragon, may also have a role here, because that could be viewed by some as a bad birth year, thus affecting the phenomenon, right? Making people want to get in there early.
Kind of double it up, right?
Right.
Like, if you're going to have a kid, it's beneficial to have a dragon, and then right after that is a snake, which some people might not want.
Better to hit the dragon before the snake or hit horse afterwards. Unless you're in South Korea, which also uses a form of the zodiac, where horse males are apparently favored and horse females are not, and the gender ratio of births in horse years skews male.
Huh.
And the reason here is, on one hand, you know, abortion may play a role, the aborting of female offspring, but also misreporting a birth date in order to hit a more desirable zodiac year. So if you're on the fence, if your kid's on the fence of possibly being a horse, and you don't want her to have that kind of association, then you could just say, oh, she's not a horse. I'm sorry. She's a snake.
Okay. So now I think it's time to turn our attention to the fate of dragon children. Is a dragon child really more likely to succeed in the world than children born under other signs?
Yeah. Is the magical thinking involved here, is that giving them is that projecting some sort of importance on them? Is it giving them a boost? Is it putting too much pressure on them? Are they going to have opportunities that other individuals are not going to have just because of their birth year?
Yeah, well, there was a 2002 Forbes article titled "Is Success in the Stars?" by Virginia Citrano, and that compared birth year on Forbes's list of the 400 wealthiest Americans at the time. That's interesting. Remember that?
Yeah.
Americans. And what did they find? Well, son of a gun, even in this list of Americans, the Dragons came out on top. 43 of the Forbes 400, or 10.75%, were born in dragon years, which was more than any other Chinese zodiac sign, which is weird. Yeah. I mean, so maybe there is something to this superstition, but then again, this is Americans. I mean, a lot of these people probably are not even aware of what Chinese zodiac sign they are.
Yeah. Or if anything, they probably have just that Chinese menu association that we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. But then there was a paper in Economic Inquiry called Do Dragons Have Better Fate? This came out in 2005 by, Kafu Wong and Linda Young. And, Wong and Young investigate whether dragons actually have better outcomes in life by looking at data sets from the 1991 and 1996 Hong Kong census. And the authors explain that the Hong Kong census data was used because, one, most of the community in Hong Kong is Chinese. Two, the lunar calendar is used extensively. And three, this census model provides data on other useful variables like level of education.
Okay.
And so Wong and Young found that in the 1991 census, dragons actually did have a slightly higher than average mean earnings variable. So they're comparing year of birth to how much money you make. It was plus 4.85% on earnings. But in 1996, dragons had a slightly lower than average mean earning report with a negative 0.22%. However, They said that when mitigating variables like schooling are taken into account, they conclude that that quote, statistically, the coefficients are unstable across census years and insignificantly different from zero in most cases. So ultimately, they don't find any strong evidence for the superstition that dragons do better.
Okay. So an effect on birth rates in some places? Yes. An effect on the actual success level of individuals born in that year? No evidence at all.
Well, there, you know, as we said, in one of the years, there was a slight advantage. Mm-hmm. In another year, there wasn't. And they said overall, when you compare it to years of schooling and stuff like that, a strong trend does not emerge.
Okay.
But there could be other reasons that, that a dragon birth could seem to have an effect, that you could look at the people around you in society or look at yourself and say, hey, yeah, man, those dragons are really great. I want to have a dragon child too. And it wouldn't necessarily have to be economically measurable. It could be entirely based on, you know, sort of human capital or just social perception. And here I want to bring in something that we've talked about in a previous episode, which is the role of the Forer effect, also known as the Barnum effect. We'll use those interchangeably, Forer and Barnum, in astrology. So if you missed our episode, Something for Everybody, the Forer effect from July 23rd, 2015, let's do a brief refresher on it. What was the Forer effect?
All right. So what we're talking about here is the tendency of people to accept vague general personality descriptions is highly accurate and applying to them specifically.
Yeah. This is why these personality tests are so popular.
Yeah. Like any of those descriptions we made earlier, we say, oh, here are the pros and the cons of year of the rat. And if you're year of the rat, you instantly cling onto the things that seem to fit, that you know are true, the things you would like to be true. And if something doesn't quite stick, you just let it fall away.
Yeah, and it helps the more general the description is. So there are a few things we found in that episode were especially conducive to people judging personality descriptions, especially vague general ones, mm-hmm. as applying specifically to them. One is that if it's supposedly tailored to them by a competent authority, and in some cases a competent authority may include something like tradition, you know,
yeah.
a zodiacal tradition could be considered a competent authority, or especially if it's flattering or favorable to the dupe in question, you or me. You're more likely to accept descriptions of yourself that sound kind of good.
Yeah.
Now, there was a study on the Barnum effect or the Forer effect and popular horoscopes in the Journal of Psychology in 1983 by Catherine S. Fichten and Betty Sunnerton. This is an older paper, but I think it's interesting and it applies to what we're talking about here. It's also going to be dealing with Western astrology, not Chinese astrology, but mm-hmm. I think the same principles can apply in interesting ways. So this was carried out in 1983, and what they addressed was the perceived accuracy of astrological personality descriptions. So an interesting starting question is this. Sometimes even non-believers, people who are not into astrology. They don't give it any credence. Will read an astrology-based description of their signs, supposed personality traits, and report finding this description highly accurate. So you are a Scorpio, and I tell you what a Scorpio's personality is supposed to be like, and you're like, "Whoa, but that's me." Yeah, how could they know so much? So they got 366 college students, and they examined A, individual differences associated with horoscope reading habits, B, the reliability and validity of daily and monthly horoscope forecasts and astrologically based personality descriptions, and C, the effects of knowing the zodiac sign on the perception of usefulness of horoscope forecasts and on the accuracy of astrologically based personality descriptions. So we're mainly interested in the second half of B and in C there, how accurate these personality descriptions are, and whether it matters that you know zodiac signs. So they broke it up like this. There were 203 subjects that rated 13 one-paragraph personality descriptions on a 10-point scale from not at all like me to very much like me. So it might say, you're very brave, powerful, courageous, and strong. You love lobster, butter, and jetpacks. and you would say, yeah, that sounds a lot like me, or no, that does not sound very much like me. And so 12 of these descriptions came from a couple of different purse-size horoscope booklets, and the 13th was a control paragraph that was known as a Barnum paragraph, or what it was playing on the Barnum Forer effect. It was a personality description specifically designed to appear highly accurate by exploiting this Forer effect.
Okay.
It contained vague statements that have a very high base rate of occurrence in the population. It was supposed to be the kind of thing that anybody would look at and say, yeah, that's me. Some of the subjects got to see the paragraphs identified with the appropriate zodiac sign. So that it would say like Cancer and then describe the personality. Others just saw the paragraphs without the zodiac signs associated with them and no indication of the astrological significance. And one of the things before I report the results is that it's important to emphasize that this was studying self-perceived validity, mm-hmm. not externally verified validity. So it's what people's idea is of how well it describes them, not how well it actually matches any external behavior.
Okay. And interesting too here is that on one hand we have the description, and then on the other hand we have a description with the symbolic power of the zodiac.
Yeah, exactly. In a separate part of the paper, one that we're not really focusing on, they found that the daily and monthly forecasts were unreliable. You know, so when it tells you like, hey, what you're going to need to do today as a Cancer is not choke to death on a hot dog and make an investment with somebody who offers you an opportunity. Those kinds of things, they match those to previous days, and it turned out that these had no effect whatsoever. They were not any more reliable for the one's own zodiac sign than for the other ones.
Yeah, they were so specific that they just didn't hold up.
Yeah, these were the forecasts for events. But the personality descriptions, on the other hand, were in some cases found to have some significant reliability, and this is the weird thing. They say, quote, an average of 4.12 of the 12 personality descriptions were matched correctly by the 17 subjects. The probability of such results being due to chance is less than 5%. So that's kind of weird. So when no identification of personality descriptions with zodiac signs was supplied, the subjects, first of all, they clearly liked the Barnum paragraph the best.
Yeah.
The one they thought that most accurately described them was not a zodiac paragraph at all. It was just this Barnum paragraph that's supposed to match anybody. But when the subjects knew the zodiac signs associated with the descriptions, they tended to think that their own sign's description was more accurate than that of the 11 other signs. But there was an unexpected finding. With one of the two astrology books, the Purse Book B, the second one, even when the descriptions didn't have the zodiac sign matched with them, people found their own. I'm a Cancer and I'm reading through these unlabeled personality descriptions. I was more likely in the study to pick the description linked with the Cancer sign, even when it didn't say Cancer.
Huh.
Wow. And that is weird. That makes me wonder, wait a minute, is there something to astrology? Well, no, the Purse Book B was not full of real magic. Subsequent analysis of the data showed that when someone who had at some time in the past read a description of their own sign's personality, they tended to rate their own sign's descriptions as more accurate even when it wasn't identified by the sign. Thus, the culprit could simply be conscious or unconscious familiarity with what the sign is supposed to be like.
Oh, wow. So, even it's the shadow of that symbol, of that sign.
Yeah, and these people didn't have to be deep into astrology. Mm-hmm. It could be somebody like me who I don't pay attention to astrology. I don't really know anything about it, but I have read the Cancer description sometime in the past. And if I answered that way on the questionnaire, it turned out I could look at unlabeled descriptions of personalities and pick the one for Cancer as most likely applying to me.
Okay.
And I just want to read a quote from their conclusion. They say, two possible mechanisms underlying the effect of familiarity on acceptance of personality descriptions can be proposed. First of all, having read that as a Virgo, you are an honest person, one's self-assessment may come to include the trait honest. So in that way, the personality description, once you've read it, it actually influences how you think of yourself. Back to them. A personality description which stresses honesty may therefore be accepted as an accurate characteristic of oneself. Alternately, having some previous information about one's supposed character traits, e.g. I'm a Virgo, Virgos are honest, may give one the opportunity to notice and subsequently recall instances of behavioral confirmation. I returned the bus ticket to the man who dropped it. That was really honest of me. Thus, familiarity may operate in this instance through having repeatedly noticed oneself behaving in an honest fashion. So the second idea there is that if you've read a description of your personality before, you have primed your brain to cherry pick from then on instances of things that match with what you've read in the past.
Okay. And this, I feel like this makes particular sense, when thinking about the Chinese zodiac, because you're talking about how these different zodiac signs and symbols, and how they end up casting the shadow on our life, and you just can't avoid it, just subconsciously thinking about it. I feel like the Chinese zodiac signs are even easier to just casually fall into, because they have that animal at the center. They have that personality that, so, I mean, you look at the pig, you have enough familiarity with stories of pigs and reality of pigs, you have some idea of what that personality consists of.
Yeah, totally. The animal character brings a level of personality to the characterization that I think is just not present in many of the Western zodiac signs.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're stuck with like Pisces with the scales or whatnot.
Right.
Yeah, I always wanted a scorpion.
I'm some scales. Wouldn't it be great if it were more directly tailored to exactly what the things were? So it's like, oh, I'm a Pisces. When somebody puts something on one half of me, I tip over to that side.
I'm a Cancer and I can't help pinching people when I'm in public.
Right, exactly. Thing, yeah. I'm a Scorpio and when somebody cuts my tail off, I don't immediately die. I just can't poop until I die.
Yeah, indeed. But those would of course be way too specific. In generality, that's where the power is when it comes to a zodiac.
You know, another thing that's interesting about how this applies to society at large is the way at which I wonder if something like this could become a self-fulfilling prophecy across generations. Because think about it like this. This is just speculation. This is not based on a finding. But we do know that the Barnum effect or the Forer effect, through that, people tend to grant more credence to the accuracy of vague personality descriptions when they're worded in a favorable or flattering way. So for this reason, I think it might be sensible to guess that dragons are more likely than other people to believe in the virtues of dragons. Wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah, because the sign, like if you're a pig, some people are going to have some issues with that. In fact, it's worth remembering that there are Chinese Muslims, and I understand for a Chinese Muslim, this can be kind of rather problematic, and you end up not referring to the year of the pig as the year of the pig directly because of the pig's status in Islamic culture.
Yeah. So totally, I can see how one's like the positive or negative qualities associated with the thing can affect the extent to which you believe in it. Mm-hmm. So if you're a dragon, you might be more likely to believe in the virtues of dragons. And if selective timing and reproduction means that there are more dragons than any other animal of the zodiac over time, especially in, I don't mean across all Chinese, but in certain areas where this is a pronounced trend, this could also mean that there are more adults of reproductive age every generation that believe in the superiority of dragons because they themselves are dragons and thus also aim to produce dragons. So could this lead to something like a runaway dragon effect?
Oh, wow.
I'm just imagining like a sci-fi story where there's a culture where something like this has happened over many generations. And it gets to the point where they only breed a large crop of new children once every 12 years because of the terrible taboo on children born as non-dragons.
Huh. I like that sci-fi vision there, Joe.
Somehow I suspect that's probably not going to happen in the real world because there are just enough other factors controlling when people give birth. And the fact that, as we've said, it doesn't seem to be that people are strongly motivated by a powerful belief in the Chinese zodiac and like that this is the main thing deciding when they have a child, but that maybe if it's convenient, it might kind of push you a little bit in that direction.
Yeah,
even
just
some
scales.
Yeah, some vague, loose cultural knowledge. Even just if you don't believe in the magic of it, but have some positive associations about dragons, it might make you want to do it.
Yeah, the sweet spot here seems to be not rigid belief in it, and also not the complete rejection of it, but that place in the middle where it's not really a part of your daily conscious life, but you cannot escape its cultural hold on you.
Oh, I think that's the way most of us interact with our cultural superstitions, right? I know I'm that way, that I don't, if you pin me down, I don't believe in any of these superstitions. I don't actually believe it's bad luck to cross a black cat's path. I don't actually believe one shouldn't walk under a ladder. But I know that when there are no stakes involved, that it might sort of influence the path I take when I'm walking.
Yeah, exactly. If all things being equal, which path are you going to take? The one that looks a little spooky or the one that, that doesn't?
Even though I don't believe in it, it's just kind of there. It's a cultural association. And when I'm not otherwise motivated by any other strong factor, it kind of guides me.
Yeah, and I think that's the remarkable thing about this topic. It really helps to illuminate the power of myth, the power of symbolism, and the power of sort of background folklore over our lives.
Hey, I mean, that's one of our favorite themes here.
Yeah. Now, obviously, we'd love to hear from all of you. What's your zodiac sign? Do you feel it's accurate? Do you feel like it's made a marked impact on your life in any way whatsoever?
Uh-huh.
And we know that we have listeners who grew up in Chinese households as well. If so, I'd love for you to share your experience with us on these matters, because obviously the Chinese zodiac is going to cast more of a shadow on your life than it did on ours.
Oh, one of the things I would love to hear is if you're a person who knows more about the Chinese zodiac, who understands some of the complexities that are no doubt lost on us. I mean, we only have the that placemat kind of understanding, I think.
Yeah, placemat and then, you know, some book learning on top of that, but that's about it.
Yeah, if you are somebody who knows a lot more about the complexities of the Chinese zodiac and wants to get in touch with us about that, we'd love to hear from you as well.
Exactly. And hey, in the meantime, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That is where you will find all the podcast episodes, including this one. And I'll make sure that the landing page has some links out to related material on the site, as well as some of the resources we used in researching it. Also, there are videos there. There are blog posts. You'll also find links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr. We are Blow the Mind on all of those.
And if you want to get in touch with us about any of those things we brought up just a little while ago, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.